I also find hope when I see that all over the country, people go to the mechanisms of democracy to have their fights, whether it is in city councils or school boards or any other locus of political power that involves ballots, not bullets.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight.
My guest today is Nathaniel G. Perlman, the host of the Great Battlefield Podcast and an entrepreneur with an interest in and commitment to progressive politics. For over 1,000 episodes now, I've been the interviewer, talking to a variety of great people working to protect and improve our democracy. For this, the second part of my 1,000th episode, I get to be the guest on my own show. You might want to listen to the first part first if you haven't already. Again, I've invited former guests and a few others to do a group interview of me. So a fair number, too many really, have submitted questions in audio form. Some were straightforward, some were challenging or provocative, and some were out of my expertise. But I'm trying to answer them all. I've been stitching those answers and questions together into this three-part episode. If you're not among those asking me questions so far, feel free to send me the audio of your own question and I'll try to fit it in. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, this is episode 1000 part 2 with more questions of Nathaniel, host of the Great Battlefield Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Okay, to start it off, I got three somewhat similar questions about what I've changed my mind about during the 7 years of the podcast. These were from former guests Anna Galland, former guest, and my sister, Eve Perlman, and Dan Leone, my first podcast sound editor. So I'll play those three questions now. The first is Anna.
What's something you've changed your mind about over the course of 1,000 episodes?
Hi, this is Eve Perlman, Nathaniel Perlman's sister. And my question today to you, Nathaniel, is if there's an example or examples of things that you've heard or learned or seen in these interviews that have challenged and changed your established beliefs about politics and social justice or social change. What have you heard that have helped your beliefs grow and evolve?
Hi, Nathaniel. It's Dan Leone. I'm coming to you from a windy day in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Congratulations on 1,000 episodes of the Great Battlefield Podcast. And I'm wondering, after doing 1,000 episodes and having all the conversations that you've had, how has your mind changed? So in all these conversations that you've had, what has your perspective shifted on? How do you look at things differently? Yeah, that's my question. How has your mind changed in all these years and all these conversations? Thanks.
Well, first I'd like to say to Anna, Eve, and Dan that great minds must work alike, because to have three people that I respect ask me this challenging question, each in your own way, is pretty telling. What does it mean to change my mind? Does it count if I've obtained whole new areas of knowledge and seen new priorities rise in importance for me and broadened my outlook on the progressive ecosystem and become more tolerant of a breadth of viewpoints? Because I think that's generally what has happened. I was 51 when I started, and I'm 58 now, and I was reasonably well-formed ideologically coming in, and I haven't undergone a major revamping of my beliefs, but I have grown tremendously and become much more well-informed through this course of study. As I've talked to people and read their books and articles and followed threads of inquiry from one guest to the next, I've come to understand things about major areas of work and who's influential in those areas that I did not even know existed or knew very little at all about. From political reforms like ranked choice voting, or how organizing is taking place to improve the lot of domestic workers, to how well Trump fits the authoritarian playbook, to understanding the number of Trumpers, to the role of progressive donor advisors, to what is happening in the world of progressive technology startups, to how political collaboration happens in the states, or that there's a whole ecosystem of groups working to facilitate talking across political divides in this country, or how many social movements are sourced out of the same hubs of knowledge, or what's going on with different organizing traditions, or what new political groups were spawned by the Trump victory in 2016, or how influencers on different platforms like TikTok are being connected to progressive groups, all that and much more. With my sister Eve, I've had many spirited discussions from two different sides of the Bernie-Hillary schism during that primary, and was very influenced by her viewpoint that Sanders represented an important moral stance, and I continued to look for people to talk to who represented that well. Generally, my initial impulse was to interview with an open mind across the ideological spectrum from left of the Democratic Party, and also seeking out what they would call themselves more moderate, common-sense Democrats and anti-Trump Republicans. Those conversations have reinforced my impression that there's a lot of value in the varying opinions that are held by different members of potential winning coalitions, and I find myself broadly sympathetic to idealists and pragmatists, leftists and moderates alike. So I'd say, in sum, that my mind has changed a great deal, but I haven't changed my mind too much, if that makes sense. And I'm probably less confident of any particular viewpoint that I have now, not more, perhaps with the exception of my conviction they were all together on the necessary and proper side of the battlefield at this time in history. And one thing that has remained constant for me is that I know that I don't have all the answers. All I can do is try to ask some of the right questions.
Hey, Nathaniel, this is Catherine Vaughn. My question for you is, what has surprised you the most since starting this podcast and talking to leaders from all around the political space?
Hi, Catherine Vaughn of Flippable and Swing Left. It surprises me that most people on our side often know very little about what the other side is doing in building their own ecosystem. I used to frequently ask this question of my guests, but I ask it rarely nowadays because as a group, we don't seem to spend a lot of time gathering this data. Maybe we need an organization that does. Or maybe we have one and I don't know about it. Tell me.
Hi, Nathaniel. This is Kathy Morse calling from Vermont. I spend a lot of time with college students these days, and they can be pretty anxious about how best to join the fight on the great battlefield. You have met and interviewed and hired and mentored lots of folks over the years. If you were to boil down your advice to joining the fight after college to, say, 3 to 5 nuggets of wisdom that you've learned over the years, what might they be? And congratulations on your 1,000th episode. Bye.
For those who don't know, Kathy Morse is professor of environmental studies and also professor of history at Middlebury College. And Middlebury has produced a lot of students that have played important roles in building the progressive ecosystem. Based on my many interviews with political people, you don't have to worry too much about each decision you make about where to work. Political careers are pretty forgiving, and you'll have time to try different things. If your concern is how to have the most impact with your time, just remember that you're one of hundreds of millions of people, and all you can do is your best, and there's no way of completely maximizing your impact. So listen to some smart people and choose something that feel like a fit to play your part. Anyway, Kathy, you wanted 3 to 5 nuggets of wisdom about how to join the fight, so I'll take a stab at that, though it really sounds like a full episode or a full 1,000 episodes. Politics is a very permeable space, not hard to get in on an entry level somewhere, even as a volunteer, and not hard to climb up if you work hard and do a good job. If you're thinking about full-time, don't necessarily go for the biggest campaign or organization, like a presidential campaign or Planned Parenthood, unless you have an in with one of them. Small organizations and local campaigns need smart people, rarely have the resources to recruit, and are eager for help. So look for something that really fits you and can use you. Also, politics is a team sport. Try not to get hung up on Biden versus Trump, but realize that you're part of picking between two enormously different political parties and teams, and all of the appointments go to the winning team. So don't worry so much about party labels, because both parties really extend far outside those people who call themselves Democrats or Republicans. So join the coalition that fits you and find a place that you're comfortable with the mission. Also, use your personal skill set, communications, technology, research, analytical skills, all of these and more are needed. If you can only work part-time, use one of the existing organizations that employs science to help you focus your time. Groups like Swing Left, Arena, Sister District, or numerous others, see the endless list at my podcast website, can help you decide where and how to apply your time. And ask somebody who's connected to a lot of organizations to help you reach out. I've done that a lot. Check in with me if you'd like. And don't worry, it's only the future of the country and the planet at stake. I received a number of questions about how to start an organization or a business, particularly in the political technology space. I've spread some of my thoughts around among them and I'm open to emails or phone calls if someone wants to discuss things more specifically. I definitely enjoy talking about the subject, especially if you have a really good idea.
Hi, Nathaniel. Congratulations, and thank you for the gift to the progressive community of these 1,000 podcasts. You've started a number of companies and nonprofits that have been successful. What's your best advice for somebody who has an idea in order to, for them to get it launched?
Hi, Stu Trevelyan. You've started or grown a thing or two yourself, even though not everyone knows you built CTSG before taking the helm at NGP Van Every Action. And I appreciate the question and the characterization of my podcast. I'd be interested in your answer to your own question. My advice to a wannabe founder of anything, really, is to start today and make some progress every single day. I've talked to so many people who have a hankering to start their own thing, and with some of them, I've had that same conversation many times over the succession of years, and time has passed by, and they still didn't do it. You don't have to start your thing full-time. You don't have to quit your job. But you have to push the idea that you have forward at least a bit every day, or it makes no progress. And the sum of even small daily progress is substantial over time. Additionally, it wouldn't hurt to find a mentor, a Stu Trevelyan sort of person who's been there before, to hit up with questions.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Josh Nelson with Civic Shout. Congratulations on episode 1000. Here's my question. If you could give one piece of advice to someone thinking about starting a political tech company, what would you tell them?
Hi, Josh. Just one piece of advice to someone else thinking about starting a new political tech company. Here's a basic one. If you're entering the business of politics, you're entering what in most cases is a very cyclical business. Be prepared to have your window of opportunity open and shut repeatedly. If that's true for your idea, organize the business around that political cycle or find a counter-cyclical adjacent market for the downtimes. Be prepared for a multi-cycle test of what you're trying, something which is likely to require a longer time to get to success than many other areas of the economy. Hold extra money gained in flush times for lean times, and look at how other similar businesses in the space have navigated in similar waters over time.
Hi, Nathaniel. This is Shai Sachs. I'm a huge fan of your show. My question for you today is, what advice would you give to a new political entrepreneur? What sort of problems should they work on? How should they attack those problems? What do they need to do to succeed? Anything else that comes to mind? Thanks very much, and congratulations on 1,000 episodes.
Hi, Shai. I know that you were an innovation platform engineer at NGP Van for a long time, and even though you've moved on to be a software architect in the commercial space, I'm glad you still track ideas in the progressive political technology world. In most cases in politics, you really should not try to start an organization or start building technology until you really understand the existing domain and know what people have already tried that is similar to your idea. Working for an existing organization that's closest to what you want to do would be smart. This is not to say that an intelligent person can't spin up relatively quickly, but startups are tough anywhere, and the political startup space is littered with failed attempts, large and small, generously funded, and unable to find sufficient resources by people who got a quick look at the space and proceeded to build something that did not fit or did not fit in. So if you're a wizard of a technologist, it would help to include someone who is as much a political animal and as steeped in the lingo and the alliances and the values and the history as you are steeped in the newest tech. I promise that if you proceed with some humility and listen more than you talk, both to potential customers and to potential partners, you will likely find that people end up assisting rather than blocking you. As far as what to tackle, I'd pick an area that is currently understood to be underserved or broken, because people will want you to succeed there. Therefore, unless you have very large resources, begin with a small problem and grow from there. And as far as how, I recommend familiarity with the concept of a lean startup.
This is David Radloff over at Clarity Campaign Labs. My question is, what advice would you offer to someone starting a business now? And what sort of support is most helpful to aspiring entrepreneurs?
Hi, David. You are also a serial political entrepreneur, and you know that entrepreneurship can be lonely. I do think it is smart for entrepreneurs to seek support outside their organization, whether from professionals like lawyers and accountants, but also from business or nonprofit mentors, coaches, consultants, or peers. David, for a bunch of years now, you've been a member with me of an entrepreneur's peer forum, which is a group of 8 to 10 business owners who meet, usually monthly, to discuss their businesses and life. I never thought that would be the kind of thing for me, but when my first business started getting complicated, I joined a forum on the recommendation of a few friends and have now been with it for 20 years. I also spent some time in other peer forums, including Vistage and Executive Peer Forum as well. Even dissimilar businesses have similar challenges, and it's good to find a place of confidentiality where you can discuss these issues with people who can understand and helpfully share their own experiences. So my recommendation is not to be shy about finding support.
There are so many amazing entrepreneurs that you've interviewed, so many people starting new things, and that's one of the beautiful parts of our movement is how many talented people start a venture. And I was wondering if you could design some kind of mechanism to try to reduce redundancy, to try to create more collaboration, to try to make our beautiful thousand flowers blooming more efficient. What would that mechanism look like? What would that institution or initiative look like to try to accomplish that?
Hi, Yoni Landau. To some extent, you're trying to build part of a mechanism like this yourself with Movement Labs, where you're incubating a variety of ideas and running a variety of programs and testing them to see what works. I think it's easy to be a critic of the redundancy and lack of collaboration in the progressive political ecosystem. We do have a lot of challenges, but I actually think we're improving, and I'm as much an admirer as a critic of what is going on. What are our current mechanisms for cultivating the garden of our many flowers and separating out the weeds? There are a lot of them, and I'm not sure that's a bad thing. For products and services, we have the buying market itself, which is whoever is going to consume your services and whether they want them. If you're providing something for free, then it's your funders. You're only going to build a lasting organization in this space if you have some way of financing it for the long term, which means you need to do things that people are willing to pay you to do, either directly or indirectly. And then we have the founders themselves, who often find ways to combine organizations or make hard decisions to fold their own operations. Is this a flawed and frustrating methodology? Yes. Funders can drop their commitments or change their priorities. Customers can fail to materialize. And outside your startup, huge amounts of money can be spent on things that seem demonstrably wasteful, while your own conviction about what to do goes unrecognized. You could argue that we need some kind of top-down system for coordinating political entrepreneurship. Well, we actually have a lot. Groups like Higher Ground Labs and New Media Ventures, the Democracy Alliance, and all of the donor advisors connected to various wealthy progressives, not to mention collective buyers like Movement Cooperative, and all the normal sources of funding available to founders of nonprofit or for-profit enterprises outside of politics. What's funny about these existing decision makers is very often when I talk to them, they're very critical of the judgment of others. They think almost everyone else is wasting a lot of their time. think it's a lot harder than it looks to recognize a great idea and a team that might take it to success. So there's a virtue to duplication and chaos that may go unnoticed because nobody comes close to getting it all right. I'm not sure that isn't a pretty good setup, at least for generating new ideas and also letting them fail. It's certainly way better than it used to be. And my sense is that in political tech and outside it, people are collaborating way more than they used to. My prediction is we continue to get better at this, and I myself am looking at ways to be helpful.
So, Nathaniel, you've talked to a thousand of the most interesting people in and around politics and technology. What would you say are the one or two qualities or elements that makes people most successful in this world? Because I don't think it's getting straight A's in computer science class or in poli sci based on those episodes.
Hi, Laura DeLucia, who's run the operations for institutions all over Democratic politics, as well as some outside politics. First of all, I observed you quite a bit when you worked for me before moving on to the Obama campaign, and I would attribute your success from what I've seen to just how hard you work and how well you learn and the positive spirit that you always bring with you. In general, the people I admire most are taking advantage of their own personal qualities and strengths and pursuing their chosen project because they see something that can be improved and they take a genuine interest in tackling it in a way that aligns their talents with moving things in the right direction as they see it. So I think the answer is really an individual one, finding your own fit in the world. And if that's in politics and technology, you'll know it, as I did. In other words, what is likely to make you successful in politics and technology or anything else is if you're excited about it, have skills, or can develop them in that area, and work hard. Pretty simple. And it does not hurt to be a good and kind person, someone people will want to be around.
This is Arthur Thompson, the Chief Technology Officer of the Democratic National Committee. Nathaniel, congratulations on a monumental run and helping to spotlight some incredible work in the political space over these last 999 episodes. My question for you is, your podcast has helped spotlight so many great people working in political tech today. Who do you think is an important figure over the last couple decades that doesn't get enough recognition?
Hi, Arthur. You ask a good question, and maybe I do not know how to answer it the way you meant it. To some degree, it goes to who I still want to interview for the podcast, to the degree that that can be considered some kind of recognition. The temptation for any host is to find the most well-known figures to interview, and I confess I felt excited when I got to interview Howard Dean or Martin O'Malley or Mitch Landrieu, people who are known by millions, or even someone like you with a title that means something to a large number of people within our ecosystem. And I noticed that somewhat unfortunately, listeners tend to be more interested in someone with some degree of what we might call star power, rather than someone who is maybe more of a risk to spend the time with. But I mostly avoid, for example, politicians if they're holding or running for elective office. I've enjoyed learning about people who are new to me. But even there, I recognize that I've aimed my search for guests at founders, executive directors, political entrepreneurs, professors, and other people who get to claim credit for what they or their organizations do. And these people do interest me, partially because of what they know and what their challenges are, and partially because I've had that kind of position myself. But what all of us know is that while leaders are important, a great deal of the work and creativity and achievement that takes place in organizations is done by those who are rarely celebrated. The people who do not have elevated titles but push the mission forward, make key suggestions for improvement, and keep their leaders honest. So my answer is that the important figure who doesn't get enough recognition is the mostly anonymous staffer. But if you notice, the way I delve into biographies, many of the people that I highlight talk about their time in anonymity and how they rose out of it. So maybe I'm celebrating that a bit.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Brent Kimmel in Reston, Virginia. Congratulations on your 1,000th episode. I've been a big fan of Great Battlefield since episode one, and I have a question for you. 20 years have passed since the infamous Dean Scream. How do you look back on that campaign as the OG of progressive political technology? Was it the juggernaut of innovation it was made out to be? Was it a lost cause that was tragically ahead of its time? Or was it a warning about the perils of drinking our own Kool-Aid and staring a little too deeply into our technology and metrics in lieu of connecting with and understanding mainstream voters.
Hi, Brent, former DCCC and DNC tech guy, and now I just learned engineering lead at Squarespace. I think the Dean campaign was some part of all those things you mentioned and more. There was a lot of political tech innovation there, though it was going on in other campaigns as well. And the candidate and his position on the war and the reaction from online activists was crucial to having the energy in the real world to harness. We can never forget that real politics matters more than whatever the technology we are using as a multiplier or facilitator of communication or fundraising. Certainly, no one can recount the history of technology in democratic politics without covering the 2004 Dean campaign. For that reason, and others, I've had a large number of former Dean campaign luminaries on the podcast over the years. Those include Howard Dean himself, episode 208, his first campaign manager, Rick Ritter, episode 145, Joe Trippi, the second campaign manager and political internet evangelist, episode number 167, Nico Mealy, the campaign webmaster who founded Echo Ditto after the campaign, episode number 500, Bobby Clark, director of internet fundraising, episode number 697, Ben Self, database architect at the campaign, later CTO at the DNC and one of the founders of Blue State Digital, episode number 88, Stephanie Shriok, who was national finance director, episode number 874, and others. So it might be better to ask any of these folks this question. In my case, that political year, I had something of an inside view into a lot of the technology operations of a number of Democratic presidentials as one of their technology providers, especially to Kerry and Gebhardt, not to mention many other presidential campaigns in later cycles. Though the Dean campaign attracted innovators and encouraged them to flourish, what mostly distinguished Dean from Kerry Online was what I referred to earlier, much less the tech operation than the candidate's positioning and relationship of the campaign to people who liked the idea of Dean as representing what he called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. That dynamic was not dissimilar to what happened with Obama versus Clinton in 08, Sanders versus Clinton in 16, or a number of the other campaigns versus Biden in 20. As I've suggested over and over in this podcast, we can't only get the tactical stuff like our political technology right, though we want it there to harness energy properly. The big strategic stuff, meaning what we do, what we say, and who and how we say it, matters more.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Kate Gage. My question is, we all know that not all great ideas make it. Sometimes they don't get off the ground, and sometimes they do, but they don't last or can't find funding, or many other reasons. Of all the projects, organizations, companies, initiatives you've interviewed or you just know about through your illustrious career, which do you wish had lasted or wish had gotten off the ground that didn't, and why? Thanks so much.
Hi, Kate of Cooperative Impact Lab. People keep trying to do a political social network with tools or an activist connection platform. I've seen a number of them over these years, some very well funded, some not. That includes Blue State Digital with the Obama campaign and the DNC and what Cheyenne and Unified are currently working on. I'm thinking of all the vote.com, voter.com, grassroots.com, Brigade, to some degree, the multiplicity of tools for relational organizing, national field, countable, state.it, and many others, including some I don't know about, I'm sure. Most of these haven't survived or thrived. And the political parts of big commercial social networks seem to become as antisocial as pro-social over time and don't have political tools. Maybe NGP Van should build something for users of Van to collaborate across campaigns and expand from there. But something like this might have to grow from bottom up in people's neighborhoods. It would certainly be good to have a place designed to help us come together and coordinate instead of drift apart. I'd like to see a political social network with useful campaigning tools happen at scale on our side of the great battlefield.
Hey, Nathaniel. The question I have for you is about how software has evolved over time. What is the most interesting change in software from your own personal experience?
Hi, Josh of Campaign Deputy. I'm unfortunately quite a long way in time from my programming days, but what wasn't available to me when I was getting going, that I envy you in this time, is the ability to connect things together real time over the internet, whether it's connecting products through APIs or data, through some kind of shared cloud-based backend, or connecting processes or components built in different languages in different places by different people. It's mind-boggling to me what can be done. When you add in machine learning and AI and so many available components, it's just a different world nowadays. Take advantage of it.
Hey, Nathaniel. Congratulations on your 1,000th podcast. It's been such a great resource for the progressive community and the technologists that build for it. My question for you is, as you look ahead to the next 4 or 8 years of technology for the movement, what do you think is going to have the biggest impact on users' lives and their ability to leverage technology to be better organizers, strategists, engagers in the space?
Hi, Kat Atwater of Community Tech Alliance. It's a good question. Perhaps someone is going to figure out how to better move each progressive individual's political data out to their own care and use, as well as providing individualized tools for their actions. That is making people who are not clients into micro users as well, with their own personal data available across tools and organizations. For example, I should be able to manage my own address and contact information and political preferences through my own interface and make it available to the whole ecosystem, then see and add my own contributions and actions, see my own voting history, get recommendations for what to do, and then share what I've done back to the various progressive organizations and campaigns. Actually, I'd like to see that for my relationship with the various governments too. A little database of political me tied to everything relevant. What do you think?
Okay, Nathaniel. You asked me for a question. This is Tamer Mokhtar, founder of All Americans Vote. After 2016, there were something like 1,000 new startups in the area, in the progressive ecosystem. It's kind of a meta question, but do you think, relative to all of the talent and energy that came into the space, that the collective met, exceeded, or did not meet expectations?
Hi, Tamer. If I had to guess, I would think that you would say that relative to the talent and energy that came into the space, collectively, we did not meet expectations. I know you worked with Reid Hoffman and Dimitri Melhorn and others and tried lots of experiments in funding organizations, many of which did not work. Maybe I'm wrong about that and I shouldn't speak for you. Let's discuss it sometime. But from my perspective, the work well exceeded my expectations. Perhaps that's because I did not anticipate the flowering of political entrepreneurship that we experienced in the wake of Trump's election. There are a lot of critics of what various donors or organizations invested in, and there are a lot of critics of specific entrepreneurial attempts that failed or seem small or marginal. But what I like is that we have collectively brought into the progressive space a lot of experience and experiments in trying to build new institutions. And just like with the economy more broadly, not everything makes it. But some things have, and some things will, and are change-making, and that feels additive to me and is considerably more than I expected. Of course, we still have monumental political problems, and it can be very discouraging to notice things going backwards broadly in our politics and in our republic, so it's hard to celebrate the startup ecosystem. But I personally feel a lot of admiration for what people have done and are trying to do.
Hey, Nathaniel. Teddy Schleifer here from PUC. Congrats on episode 1,000. Proud to have played a small part in 1/500th of those episodes. I've told you this before, so no compliment that you haven't been paid previously, but I'm always impressed by your ability to ask hard questions, especially as not a journalist. I don't say that in like a disparaging way. You have people on your show and You want them to have a good experience on the show, but you also ask them penetrating questions about why they left the job, right? Something like that, that people can be sensitive about answering and maybe even sensitive about asking. So I'm just curious how you come up with these sort of questions. I know it's obvious, but that's sort of the whole ball game here is how you figure out what to ask. So tell me.
How can I ask hard questions or the right kind of questions? Well, I'm not sure that I ask that many very tough questions. And this podcast is a pretty friendly forum. If it comes across that way, sometimes it's probably because I have a lot of background knowledge relevant to many of my interviews, and I do prepare as well in a lot of cases with the eye of getting a guest to tell a particular story or address a particular area of controversy after gaining some trust with them. It may be that another part of this is my native personality. I think I've always had the ability to be a bit tactless or maybe straightforward in my inquiries. And then I learned as a leader the value of not shying away from difficult conversations with employees or clients. I definitely seek, if I'm going to ask a hard question, for a way to do that and still be liked. So a lot of times I'll preface that kind of question with a confession about myself. I've often done something similar to what I'm asking about. People, I think, can also sense that I have true curiosity, not a sort of a gotcha mentality. And smart people, I find, often like the challenge. Of course, I've had more than a few guests who wouldn't field questions that I thought were fair and not worth dodging. When that happens, I can feel like a bit of a failure by me in the conversation. But mostly things work out. For example, I was able to ask Ann Lewis recently questions about being owned by a private equity firm. Or quite a while ago, I was able to elicit from Chris Lundberg, the founder of Salsa, his story about losing control of his company to his board. I was not sure how either of them would field those types of questions, but they both did a very good job. And those answers, I think, made for interesting and revealing exchanges in the episode, and so are worth the potential awkwardness of the moment.
Hi, this is Brandon Kramer. I'm a DC-based documentary filmmaker with Meridian Hill Pictures, and I've known Nathaniel for many years. He's been a mentor to myself and my brother in the creation of our production company and a very dear friend over the years, and has done an interview with me for his podcast as well. My question for you, Nathaniel, is around the time that I met you, you were in the process of moving on from your position at NGP Van. And I remember thinking, why would he want to leave when his company is thriving? And I felt from you that there was something deeper that you were after. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about what was that within yourself that led you to explore other directions and sort of what is the source of that? And I'd love to hear now that we're 15 years in the future from that point, do you feel like you've satisfied, explored, ventured into that calling that you were feeling at that time?
Hi, Brandon. You're putting me on the psychologist's couch here. I was just talking with a friend who's also an entrepreneur and business owner over hot chocolate and a blueberry muffin about the dichotomy between ourselves in our personal world and ourselves in the business world. My friend has reached the point in his career, and he's a bit older than me, where he wants to be slowing down and traveling the world with his wife and not necessarily fixing problems in his company. So he has decisions to make. In my case, 15 years ago, I was in my early 40s, nowhere near retirement, but for me, as Nathaniel, I'd concluded that I didn't really want to keep doing election cycle after election cycle in the same place, even if my continuing to do so was best for the company, which, by the way, was also not clear. I was feeling like life was short and that I wanted other things in my personal life story. But that was only one of many factors. There was truly a giant hodgepodge of business and financial and family considerations that I can leave out of your more personal, emotional, and psychological query. Maybe part of it was that maybe I had exceeded my imagination and ambition for NGP and was frustrated in my ability and interest in steering a bigger enterprise successfully. I'm not really an empire builder, nor a very comfortable emperor, and temperamentally, I can't chase money for money's sake. The time that I spent working with you and your brother Lance, interviewing on film a series of entrepreneurs about how they made business and life decisions, was kind of a video precursor to this podcast, though I never finished that film. Partially, I think, because I don't know that any of those subjects really had answers on the level that I was seeking. I suppose I've always been looking for meaning in life. Introspection is in my genes as well as upbringing. I definitely found a lot of meaning for more than a decade building software for Democrats, and I have real love for that team of people that worked with me on it. But I wanted to find meaning in other ways too. In creativity, with another business in time plots and graphicacy, and in making things as I do out of wood and clay and metal, and in the landscape, like my disc golf course on my land in Vermont. The Great Battlefield podcast, among all the things I do, has turned out to be a great fit in allowing me to continue participating in the original space where I built NGP, but from a different angle and with a different skill set, and to listen to some smart people about how they came to do the things that they do that I often admire. Back when we were talking about all this, I wanted to have time to help others as well, as I try to do as an advisor or as a friend. So I feel like my post-NGP life has had a lot of fulfillment, even though only some of the things I've tried have worked. I do know that I'm very privileged to have these options, and I wish for others the time and space to find the right opportunities in life for themselves as well. Thanks for the question.
Hi, this is Hari Han from the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And the question that I have for you for your 1,000th episode is what your best prediction is for what the state of American democracy will be in January of 2025. I look forward to hearing your response.
Hi, Hari. If people who listen to this podcast don't know your work studying civic participation and organizing, they should. Look her up, folks, or find her episode. I don't have a clue where we will be in January 2025. I've tried to avoid predictions for a long time, and I don't know who can really see that far forward because we have such a very big inflection point coming up with the election. All I have now is giving me white knuckles, both massive worries and significant hopes. It feels to me like our country has a political infection, a fever, and it's not clear if time and our collective actions will break the fever anytime soon, or if we will continue to get sicker. The system feels very vulnerable, but our democratic traditions and institutions run deep. I do not think the fever is the push and pull of people trying to move us to the left or the right in normal politics. I think the fever is the willingness to lie and cheat and drum up hate and break useful norms and use a new order of disinformation and propaganda to acquire and hold on to power. I hope that in the case of a Trump victory, we have strong and organized defense of vulnerable people and institutions and start our comeback. Because I think a lot of important things will be under attack, and I also think we might be surprised at how much popular support there will be for those attacks. In the case of a Biden victory, I hope we will have a mandate for political reform and mutual outreach that leads to real improvements. And if we have a messy, contested, ugly verdict in 2024 that goes to Congress and or the courts to decide, I hope that we avoid violence and that we have an outcome that we can ultimately accept as an electorate. I do really worry that things could get out of hand. I'm grateful for people like you who are trying to hold things together.
Hi, Nathaniel. This is Susan McWilliams-Barnt, professor of politics at Pomona College. In all your interviews, where have you found the most reasons for hope in American politics?
Hi, Susan. Thanks for taking the time, and I really appreciate your focus on hope. Even though I am very deeply concerned about American politics right now, as I think anyone has to be, I do see numerous reasons for hope. For one thing, despite those who are motivated to say and see otherwise, the country's being governed pretty well. It's a huge relief from the previous presidency to see the team we have in place. Beyond that, a core function of this podcast for me is its connection to the innovative and committed people I get to talk to, most of whom are dedicating their full efforts, their intellects, their organizations, and their resources to organize their part of the fight, including those who are working on better ways to get people just to talk to each other over differences and heal conflicts. I see hope particularly in the young people, and actually of people of all ages, who have a fresh sense of justice and who are listening to those of our leaders who are bad behavioral examples and turning away from them. I also find hope when I see that all over the country, people go to the mechanisms of democracy to have their fights, whether it is in city councils or school boards or any other locus of political power that involves ballots, not bullets.
Hi, my name's Mark Sullivan. I was the founder of Voter Activation Network, and I am very proud to say that I was business partners with Nathaniel for a number of years after we merged our companies to create NGP Van. So, Nathaniel, you have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people on the podcast. Who's a person who turned out to be surprisingly funny? And I mean, you know, ha-ha funny, not it, the other kind.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for submitting the question. For you folks out there who don't know Mark, you really should listen to his episode. I wish I had people filed away by how funny they are. I remember thinking that I found Conscious Lee, the TikTok creator, episode 907, to be smart with a dry sense of humor that I liked, and his was definitely an interview that's worth listening to also. In my mind, I return often to Zoe Stein saying in the interview that she went full Zoe, which was episode 638. She was so energetic during that conversation that I could easily imagine what going full Zoe would be like. I pictured a small tornado personified, and that cracks me up. And then, of course, there's a fellow named Mark Sullivan, episode 525, who I find funny describing how Van got its name. It's the pull quote for the episode, so you can find it easily. Who am I forgetting? Send me a note if you remember someone else that you think was funny. I should make one more point here. I myself am probably the funniest person involved, but I've gone to great lengths to tamp down my sense of humor so I don't distract from the serious content going on here at the Great Battlefield. But I'm not surprisingly funny, just surprisingly unfunny compared to what I could be if I allowed myself to be unleashed. You gotta say the truth.
Congratulations on 1,000 episodes of Great Battlefield, Nathaniel. That is a massive, massive feat. This is Tara McGowan, founder and publisher of Courier. And my question for you for your 1,000th episode is hopefully not too depressing of one, but if the progressive movement is not successful at turning out enough votes to bring a Biden-Harris victory this November, who do you think is going to make up the new faces of leadership in the Democratic Party and progressive movement within that reckoning?
Hi, Tara. I guess you're probably right in that if we lose this fall, there are likely to be recriminations and quite a lot of jockeying for power among those who would like to be our next leaders. We have a great amount of talent, both young and old, but I do not look forward to the jockeying, particularly if it's done selfishly with individual careers foremost in mind. I probably am in disagreement with a lot of people on this, but what I really do not want to see is us waste time and resources on another progressive versus moderate struggle within our party. If we lose to this guy, there's going to be blame enough to go around to all parts of our coalition. I think that everybody should be pushing hard right now, wherever they sit. I disagree with anyone who's going to make the claim that we should have been more progressive or more moderate or made one particular change in policy that is their central concern. In my view, what we need right now, or if we lose, is cooperation across the breadth of those who ought to understand the threat, to rally us broadly to fend off the Trumpists. But if we do lose, I will be looking for new leaders who have the ability to articulate an inclusive vision for bringing together the opposition in a dark time, showing us how to defeat the other team together. And I'd like to see those people stepping up right now, showing that they have those chops, so that it helps fend off that eventuality.
Hi, Nathaniel.
Happy 1,000th episodes. Quite an accomplishment. My question is this. You spend so much time with Democrats and progressive members of our coalition, but here we are again with three independent candidates running for office claiming Joe Biden should not be supported in this next election, despite the consequences. Are they misguided or just legitimate parts of the progressive world offering a different sense of the future? Thanks.
You didn't identify yourself, but it's an honor to get this question from Andy Stern, the former president of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU. I understand people who have felt a connection to progressive third-party candidates historically, like Robert La Follette or Eugene Debs, and feel like they should vote for whoever is closest to their heart. But this year, with the danger that Trump poses, I don't think that anyone who will draw more votes from Biden than Trump should run. In fact, I think it's deeply irresponsible. It makes me mad, and I think these candidates are misguided, especially with the president representing a good and responsible team who has generally been quite progressive, up for re-election, and an alternative leader and team in Trump and the current Republicans who represent such a great danger to us all. As a remedy down the road, maybe we need to implement ranked choice voting for this, but I wish these supposedly progressive candidates would drop out.
You have been in the political space for many years now. You've talked to all these smart, talented people who are fighting the good fight on the great battlefield. And you yourself are one of these smart, talented people. What do we need to do to defeat Trump in November? What do you wish the Dems were doing better now?
Hi, Subrat Biswal. Really glad to have a question from you as a good friend and sometimes listener to my podcast. Here's what I think of your question. When you ask what I wish the Dems were doing better now, I think that Dems means us. Dems right now is a shortcut for everyone who simply must align themselves together to win this election, whether you want to label yourself as part of the party or not. Democracy is not a spectator sport. In this election for president, there's only one way to go to keep Trump out of power. Everyone who has time should be making that case. To boil it down, this is a team game. We have a good team, and the other team is just really bad right now. So we have to beat them, or the consequences will be very unpleasant for a lot of the most vulnerable people we have, not to mention the systems that allow us to make progress. And the various leaders with titles on our team are human beings who make mistakes and operate with imperfect information, and most of them are really trying to do the right thing. Even if we disagree with them vehemently on some priority or decision or policy or emphasis or values. So I think we all need to find the place in the barricades to locate ourselves and get into the fight. There are plenty of experts and organizations we can listen to about what might be most helpful. Even though I've talked to all the smart, talented people you refer to, I don't know how to maximize my own impact. No one really does. Let's all make our best guess and push forward.
Nathaniel, congratulations on reaching episode 1000. This is an incredible milestone, and it's been a real pleasure to follow your work and your journey the whole way. And one of the things that I've always loved about you and always admired about you is the way that you see your life through projects. And one of the things about projects is that at some point they're complete. Sometimes it's really easy to define when a project is complete, like building a table or a bench, where it's easy to see that the bench or the table is done. But I wonder, with something like the show, where you hit a milestone like 1,000, and it feels big, but it's not necessarily the end of the project, what to you would define or characterize when this project is complete or reaches a point of satisfaction that at least feels complete to you?
Hi, Lance Kramer of Meridian Hill Pictures. Funnily enough, Dad actually called me Project Boy when I was a kid. And by the way, even when you build a table, you still have to decide when to stop perfecting it and call it done. I typically do that earlier than better woodworkers, so I see plenty of flaws left in the pieces I've made. A lot of the projects that you and I have discussed have been the documentary films that you and your brother pushed to completion, sometimes over the course of many years. It's really hard to say when that kind of project is done, because art like that can almost always be improved if there's money and time and energy to keep going. But sometimes you have to recognize that it's good enough, or you're out of time, or that what you're making will get worse with more fussing, and just decide to push your something out into the world. I felt like that when I was making Time Plots posters. When I was working on the visual history of the presidency, for example, after a lot of months, I finally had to say, all right, good enough. Got to move on to the next thing, even if I wasn't perfectly happy with it. What is nice is that often, with time, when you look at something you've made, it comes to feel that the way it came out is the way it should be. I've not made any new Time Plots posters in quite a few years now, because Graphicacy became, at least for now, the new vehicle for the data graphics and business impulse. It's an open question to me whether I will update the existing Time Plots, though I feel like I should, or make another of the many that I once imagined doing but did not get to. And Graphicacy itself is a big project for me, made up of numerous smaller projects that the team works on. As far as this podcast is concerned, I think I will know when I am done with it, whether the right-wing authoritarian threat will subside, or I will get too exhausted by the effort, or health problems will get me, or the process will just lose its charm, or something else will come up that captures my attention, I'll know when to quit. I also like open-ended projects like this one, not just completable ones.
1,000 Conversations allows you to see a pretty good arc of the last several years of political life. I wonder what patterns or momentum you see or have seen or can see that might suggest where we'll be or where you hope we'll be for your 2,000th episode.
Hi, Michael Slaby. You didn't identify yourself as former head of technology for the Obama campaigns, etc. I appreciate your question, even if it's a hard one for me. Sometimes in these interviews, I think I'm like the blind men trying to describe an elephant by touching it in various places and sharing their findings. Though in this, maybe I'm feeling around a very sizable donkey instead. I generally see two opposing political patterns and momentum since I started the podcast. In one direction, I think it's clear that we have escalating risks with a strengthening and consolidation of the Trumpist movement, its capture of the Republican Party, its progress in the courts and the media, a weariness in its opposition, and the increasingly ambitious plans for radical change that they've laid out. We see in the states that when these radicals get the chance, they work to change systems to hold power, and they institute noxious policies. Fortunately, though, they sometimes overreach. At the same time, I think that the coalition that sees the threat, some of the leaders of which I talk to, is pretty broad, is also learning, has its own strengths, and is actively working on growing them, and so far seems to represent more people. So if I get through a second 1,000 episodes, which seems very daunting as it would be another 7 years of my life, I hope that the patterns which have seen us win a lot of the big fights since 2016 will continue, and that over time, the stakes will have diminished. I do fear that the power of the national state, if we allow it to fall into the wrong hands, especially if it gets sustained electoral support, could make things awfully difficult for a long time for our side. That was Nathaniel G. Perlman in the second part of my 1,000th episode. Many more questions remain for me to try to answer in the next part. Hope you enjoyed it so far. And if you liked this and didn't listen to episode 1,000 part 1, you might go back and do that. You can find me at greatbattlefield.com or graphicacy.com. I appreciate feedback, so send me reactions, good or bad.